bad weather, earthquakes, you know, changing weather patterns, droughts. There's a very interesting article he talked once about. I wish I could find it. I'll have to look for it. He traced like famine, drought, pestilence, influenza, wars. He sort of traced a circle around the planet. It was at one particular period of time how one thing caused another, caused another, caused another. When our friends were in Italy during the time that there was so much war in Yugoslavia, the weather in Italy, at least where they were very close to Yugoslavia, was very strange. And they somehow felt that literally an ill wind was blowing from that dissonance, and there would be strange weather patterns and strange winds from that direction. Isn't that a strange thing? So that's all the people sort of making the world go away. Then on the other side you have in America, and all of these forces are really called together by the divine, and that's part of what Swami's book wants to bring forward, is one of what's happened progressively, and he traces in the first chapter, what's happened progressively is that God and even the idea of a divine force has just been moved farther and farther and farther out of the picture until we have no hope. That's exactly what it is. You know, we started with, as he says, with Copernicus unseating planet Earth, and then it just went from there one step after another until we became completely without hope. But anyway, the other two forces are people who are Oriental, who are Indian primarily, from India, who are Eastern in their thinking. In other words, who are part of the long tradition of the Indian culture, which has always understood that life is spiritual, that has that concept that we call Sanatan Dharma, which means eternal truth. That's not religion even. It's just simply, who am I? For what end was I made? And the perceived reality of divinity, that's what Sanatan Dharma is, and all the implications of that. And there's a massive group of people, which is really essentially us, whether you like curry or not. It doesn't really have anything to do with your sense of that culture, although many of us feel extremely at home in that culture because of that. But we all came here, and I think we came here a little time ago, to sort of run a cycle of this making the East and West together. So to us, we discover Eastern teachings, and you know, somebody will say, but it's so foreign, and we'll say, what? You know, like, this is foreign, this is natural. But the Sanatan Dharma is the natural part of it. It's not the curry and the saris and so on, but it's the sense of approaching life from this end just makes so much more sense than to approach it from the other. And so there's a whole mass of us in many areas who are just shifting the West toward a more inwardly oriented place. And then the fourth group is the American Indian tradition. And the American Indian tradition is the harmony with nature tradition, as very distinct from the Atlantean tradition. The Atlantean tradition is dominance over nature. The American Indian tradition, which is, you know, by the time the Europeans arrived in America, the Indian people themselves described themselves as the last remnant of a great people. They all the Indian cultures, American Indian cultures, had traditions of when the people were numerous. And now they were just the last, because they were doomed. It was over. You know, they were there. A few of them were left. Some of them had even degenerated from their high states because it was, of course, it had been Kali Yuga descending for a long time. And the American Indian culture as such was not destined for Dwapara Yuga. People have this great sense of tragedy about all these populations being wiped out. But if you stand back just a quarter of an inch and think about it, see, this is the problem of teaching world events from our perspective, is that those cultures were Kali Yuga cultures, and now it's Dwapara Yuga and something else is starting. And so they're all being wiped out everywhere. I mean, they're either extinct, like Polynesian culture, American Indian culture. I mean, you have tiny little pockets trying, but the lifestyle is extinct. Or they're just being absorbed into McDonald's and Burger King and polyester shirts, you know, and rubber flip-flops. Tom Friedman says that the single most universal product on the planet is rubber flip-flops. You find it everywhere. No matter how poor the culture is, you'll find rubber flip-flops, you know, those little things. Yeah, it's true if you think about it, those of you who travel. I don't know why, but he makes the oddest observations. It's really fun. He said, actually, until the war with Yugoslavia, when America bombed there, no two countries that both had McDonald's were ever at war with each other. But now even that has disappeared. Strange, isn't it? He writes the funniest books. He wrote this book called The Lexus and the Olive Tree. And he's talking about how in some parts of the world they're still talking about the olive tree, and in other parts of the world they're talking about the Lexus automobile. I mean, that's the essential theme. It's a very interesting book. It has too many words too, but it's very good. It's very interesting. It's called The Lexus and the Olive Tree. Friedman, I think, is it? Thomas Friedman. It's a good book. The reason it has too many words is he doesn't have any solutions. But, oh, is he good at describing the problems? It's fascinating the way he describes them. This is a much better book. Now, let me come back to this. Oh, the last thing about those four cultures, and it's very, I mean, this isn't, Swami hasn't written any of this in his book, but this is all part of what's behind what he's written. He said what's happening also is that the Indians of both types know that the Romans and the Atlanteans are here. And we see their role. I mean, I don't mean that we're all consciously kind of talking about or even calling ourselves Indians, but that whole faction can clearly see the other faction because it's so prominent, because the other faction is the one that appears to have all the power. That faction can't see us. I mean, they may notice us a little because occasionally somebody will chain themselves to a tractor or something like that, or go up and live in a tree and refuse to come down. So we get noticed, but they don't see us. They have no concept that we're really here. And the way Swami described it is when they finish their job of just destroying the whole thing, they'll be extremely shocked to see rising from the ashes this essentially fully intact culture, which is what we have created here. When that culture is really finished, then this one, it will be the time for this one to come forward, and it's already established. And this is probably in the context, and I never exactly thought of it like this before, but Swami has often said, without wanting to overdo the point, because it's a point which could be so easily overdone, that time will show that Ananda is the most important thing going on right now. And he'll say that, and you feel a little bit like when Master first came to America, and he was sitting in this little room in Boston, this sort of little furnished room, and it was so just small. And Master was there, and he had a couple of disciples. Dr. Lewis was one of them. And Master would sit in this little, bare, small room and say to Dr. Lewis, someday, you know, someday we'll be doing this, someday we'll be doing that. And they were both men in their 20s. Master wasn't, and he hadn't written autobiography, and he wasn't wearing a little sign, Avatar, with an explanation. He was just being himself. I mean, most of the people did not know in him. He didn't write autobiography till the end of his life. He demanded that his disciples recognize him, not that he explained himself to them, and he didn't make it easy. You have to really cognize that. Even though autobiography was written, you still had to recognize him, and that's why you would think, why didn't everybody in the whole world follow him? Because they couldn't see him. And people came to be his disciples and then left. They often left for other masters who they liked better. You know, you think of that as being incomprehensible, but not if you really put yourself into it. But Master would say about the future, and Dr. Lewis would just shake his head. He couldn't imagine it. He was a Boston dentist. He wasn't an entrepreneur. He didn't exactly have the idea of how things are done. But Swami will say from time to time, and not often, and increasingly more lately, but he'll say that Ananda's really, he'll say the most important thing. Why should I tone it down? He doesn't tone it down. He said, it's the most important thing going on. And then I remember all these things that Swami said, that the other people have power. When Christ lived and was crucified, how many people noticed that rabble-rouser was crucified? How many people had any idea that one man among many who was crucified and put in that stone sepulcher, and then there was this rumor that something remarkable happened after that? Who had any idea what the impact of that life really was? Now, if you really think about it, here we are. This place that we're sitting in is certainly the most prominent and perhaps the largest temple dedicated to Paramahansa Yogananda in the world. I say that with some question mark because I don't know how big SRF's new temple at Lake Shrine is. But this is more public. And I'm not trying to make a competition. Don't misunderstand me on any level. I'm just saying, oh my gosh. And this is an avatar. starting a whole mission, and here we sit. And if you think of it like Christ's life, and you realize it was a few, you know, people meeting in the catacombs, and then look what happened to it, and here we sit, you could see that this could turn out to be really quite significant. Now, Swamiji, that's what we have to be a little careful. We've had having this conversation with people lately. Careful in this respect, which is what we do will have much more impact than it would if it was just, if it wasn't such a public situation. Oh, we can't just decide to, let's have this ceremony, let's do that, let's change things this way, let's, I don't like this, let's do it that way, that sort of thing. We have to be much more conscious of the vibrations that we're putting forward. And the, again, you have to do this with a fine line, but, you know, the sense of responsibility. Swamiji is exceedingly careful. As innovative as he is, he's exceedingly careful. He never does anything impulsively, and he never does it without meditating very deeply to make sure that it has the right vibration. It doesn't have to have the same form, because if you try to keep things the same in form, that's the death of it, but it has the right vibration. So sometimes we try things and we say, whoops, that one didn't make it, and we move back a little bit. But the reason also why it's important is because we are doing communities. It's just as simple as that. We're the ones who are doing communities. And Master said, and again, you have to realize, Master said this, and he does not tell untruths. He said, cooperative communities, spiritually based cooperative communities, will be the lifestyle of the future. And that the day will come when this idea will spread like wildfire. Interestingly, the first thing that the Christians did in the time of Jesus was form themselves into communities. It's just a little here and there in the Bible. But they did make communities. The reason it didn't last is that these small communities, there was that battle between the Gnostics and the Catholic Church, between spirituality determined by institutional authority versus spirituality determined by individual inspiration. And little groups of small communities are center everywhere. They're not a center here coming down to you. And so the battle between the Gnostics and the institution won, and the Gnostics got a very bad reputation and went away. And here we are again. We're doing it again. But this time, we have the benefit of being Kali Yuga ascending, Dwapara Yuga ascending. And so, Swamiji, this book is Hope for a Better World, the Small Community Solution. And I have to say myself, and this is why I love to teach these books, because when I teach them, I actually understand them. When I just read them, I sort of understand them. But when I have to teach them, God tells me things that I don't know before and that sometimes I don't know afterwards either, but in that moment, I get it. And I really, just even just this little bit of a chapter, especially this chapter 2, the Copernicus chapter, him describing how, starting with Copernicus, he changed what is the center of reality. And the summary of that chapter, which it's just in simple English, but I was very struck by it, is that once we decided that God wasn't entirely just focused on mankind, which is what Copernicus taught us, we got farther and farther away from there being any center until we are where we are now, which, you know, the moral condition of our culture is simply the fact that there's nothing to hang it on. It's all just about if you can get away with it, it's fine. And of course, people have a conscience, and intuitively and instinctively and experientially, people find out that it really doesn't work if I just go out as if there were no center to life, if there were no moral structure, if anything goes. I remember years ago, many years, like 30, when we were at Ananda Village, and it was the end of the 60s, the beginning of the 70s, and the sort of the rigidity of morality was just beginning to disintegrate with the hippies and the free love and contraceptive pills and all of the different things that happened that just made things possible that weren't possible before. And people, especially young people, were way out on the edges of just experimenting instead of living these very tightly controlled lives that just went down certain tracks. And someone asked Swamiji, what did he think about the sexual revolution? I mean, he's from a very orthodox tradition. There's nothing in the orthodox scriptures that just sort of jump on these bandwagons. In fact, Ananda has always been an anomaly. I remember again in the early years of Ananda, we were the spiritual community plunked down in the middle of Nevada County. That was our only community then. Nevada County was like the center of the back to the land, the whole movement, which we were also, it was such an important thing when it was happening, and it really was. People were, that was the American Indian element. It was all going back to the land, and it was living organically and having goats and no electricity, and it was a very important movement to just repudiate the whole society. In the middle of it was Ananda, in this whole sort of counterculture of Nevada County, Ananda was there. And we looked a lot like what you would call the counterculture people, because we all had lots of hair and we had just the same sort of look. But really, we weren't anything like them, because we weren't counter anything. We were Sanatan Dharma, which was not even New Age. It was just ageless. But we looked a lot like them. But it was very confusing, because we never actually lined up with them on almost any issue except perhaps a respect for nature, because we were into transcending this world and going into the spine. And they were much more into rebelling against this world and just doing whatever they wanted. It was a very... And one man, we had just a lot of conflict up there, and one man who was very outspoken, I don't remember what we were doing. And they were also very anti-authority and anti-institution, and we were sort of the only thing that was even slightly organized in the area. We were the only target, so all that energy would direct at us. And Swami, because he just seemed to be an authority, and we seemed to respect him, so all the energy would go at him. And one man once downtown in Nevada City just said to him, what I don't like about you talking to Swami, what I just don't like about you is that you're just so darn straight, is what he said. Because he couldn't think how else to say it. But we weren't straight at all if you looked at us compared to the culture. We were way on the lunatic edge, just completely fringy in terms of what the normal society was, but we aren't anything. We're just this other reality that's just moving through. But what Swami is describing in this book, and he's describing it so well, is that we are what happens if you really accept that self-realization is the goal of life. Swamiji described his mission in life once is to create a culture for self-realization. You have the principle of self-realization, and now he's creating a culture. What does it look like? How do you do business? How do you conduct marriage? How do you raise your children? How do you educate your children? You know, how do you do creative arts? What does the music sound like? What does the dance look like? What does the religion look like if self-realization is the key? And the essence of that, as he describes in this chapter 2, which we can go back and discuss in more detail, is the understanding that once every external concept of the center of the universe, and that's what Copernicus did, the church was there sort of saying, you know, we are the God created this is here, and Copernicus started taking it apart. He just started saying that just mathematically it didn't add up. And everybody had just taken it as a fact because they were very materialistically oriented. It sort of seemed that way, so that's the way it was. See, that's what Kali Yuga is about. Kali Yuga is about whatever you see with your senses is what's true. And whatever appears to be true is true. And it's hard for us to think like that because now that it's Dwapara, there's all this other energy coming in, and we think in terms of energy and consciousness. But that's the difference. Kali Yuga is all about form, speaking of relationships and marriage and so on, which I spoke of earlier. What happened to marriage is that energy came in. It's what happens in our culture. All of a sudden, people were more concerned about what was really going on than what it looked like. And for so long, they were just concerned with what it looked like. And so as long as it looked all right, that's what you did. And just the lifestyles that people just take so for granted. In my family, it was so interesting because, you know, our generation was the generation when it began to fall apart. My brother married, and then my brother got divorced. When my brother got divorced, soon after my uncle got divorced. It was sort of like once it entered the family through the lower generation, it sort of gave permission for the other generation that it had been too frozen in the form. Suddenly the form just cracked a little bit somewhere close enough to home, and then it began to crack somewhere else. And somehow it was an absolute relationship, too. It was just the cracking of that form. But we've only had thoughts, and that's what Swami describes here, even talking about Malthus, whatever his name was, the one who talked about the population, how it just can't possibly work. It's all about systems and structures. And everything that people have been thinking and all concepts of community, and this is what Swami says, which are so interesting, and it's true, all concepts to create a perfect society have always been about systems and structures. You know, Nazism, communism, so many different experiments. Almost every one that you read is Plato's system, which Swami talks about in more detail later in this book, I believe. I mean, it was just a ludicrous system. It had nothing to do with human nature, nothing to do with the way people actually lived and related. It just all was from form outward. And that's why, as he writes in here, there's this sort of this sense of discouragement. Because all of these different form outward experiments, they just never work. I love the way Swami describes it. It was such a subtle thought that, you know, people try to gain power. Kings, the role of kings is to conquer land and to gain dominion and have more power. And they try to come in from the outside and have power by imposing it upon others. He said, but the only way you can ever have power is if you win people to cooperate with you.